BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello. The sound of summer, if ever there was one, signalling the start of the BBC's coverage of the Wimbledon fortnight. One of the more recent innovations has been the fiercely contested wheelchair version. So could the next be an event for visually impaired tennis players? We look at what's reckoned to be the fastest growing VI sport. And less summary, the latest organisation supporting us to shed staff. But first, it's back to the drawing board for the government's attempts to reform our welfare system. This programme is being recorded before tonight's debate on the welfare bill, but we already know that there's major relief for blind and partially sighted people currently receiving PIPs, or the Universal Credit Health component for those of working age without a job. But those still opposing the bill are saying that if future claimants of benefits are to be treated differently to those already getting it, with tougher eligibility rules, this will create an obviously unfair two-tier system. However, another government suggestion has now said that a consultation on the way PIPs is awarded will now include disabled people and their organisations. So how big a difference could this make for future visually impaired applicants? Well, it seems certain one of the organisations involved in such a review would be the RNIB. So we welcome Mike Worthingham, who's their head of policy. Mike, first of all, what's your overall reaction to what we can only call the government's various changes of heart?
Well, I think, as you said in your introduction, as things stand, the reported concessions will create an unfair two-tier health and disability benefit system and push many blind and partially sighted people into poverty in the future. And as people with sight loss, we face additional unavoidable costs, and these range from £65 to £175 a week. And it's unacceptable that someone newly diagnosed with sight loss in 2027, during what is already an extremely difficult time, could be hit by the tightened criteria and miss out on daily living component of PIP.
But you would acknowledge, Mike, this will be a considerable relief to those who felt threatened with the prospect of losing their personal independence payments or part of their employment-related universal credits?
It's absolutely welcome that the government have relooked at it. And we know that when the welfare changes were initially announced, our counselling service received far more calls. And so we appreciate that the anxiety has been lifted from some of us as blind and partially sighted people, but these concessions don't go far enough.
You talk about a two-tier system, but if there's to be a reassessment of how eligibility for PIPs is assessed, this could make a significant difference to future visually impaired applicants. Presumably, for instance, one of the elements that you would want to discuss is this rule in the original proposals that applicants would need to score a full 4 points in at least one of the categories within the assessment. What's your feeling about this? It's not clear in Liz Kendall's speech whether that will be changed. It just has been said, well, it won't affect current people who get PIPs.
Yes, we need more clarity, and we do need it to be changed. So under this legislation, as it stands, even with the reported concessions, blind and partially sighted people claiming PIP for the first time from November 2026 will need to score a minimum of 4 points in at least one activity to qualify for the daily living element of PIP. However, we know that some blind and partially sighted people who require PIP score just 2 in several individual daily living activities, and we feel that the current system of scoring 2 is the fairest way, and we don't feel it should change to 4 points.
So really what you'll be doing in any review is saying, as far as that element of it is, leave it as it is at the moment.
Absolutely. We don't want it to mean that blind and partially sighted people have to score 4 points.
We thought listener James put the point very clearly, who got in touch with us a little while ago, and it's worth reading again, I think. He said, we need collectively to make the case that blindness does not just affect one area of life. It's for many of us 101 daily challenges, obstacles, barriers, things we can't do without help, things that take longer, things that may be messier or even more dangerous without some level of assistance. Will you be putting those kind of points to Sir Stephen Timms, who is running this review?
We will. What we want is what we've been calling for throughout this process is proper consultation and co-production with disabled people and organisations like ours. And it's important that we are able to connect disabled people, blind and partially sighted people with decision makers to demonstrate the impact these changes have and how we have to show the barriers that we face and what support we need.
In talking about this, the government has said that, you know, this will be a question of looking at the situation of people with serious disabilities or severe disabilities. Have you rather got the impression in some of this discussion that people don't regard blindness as a serious or severe disability?
No, I haven't got the impression in our conversations with Sir Stephen Timms or with the WP that they no longer see blindness as a serious condition. I just think there's a lack of understanding of the impacts of sight loss. And in any review and in our ongoing consultations with the government, we will make that point very clearly.
How do you expect this consultation to work? I'm assuming that the RNIB would want to make sure that its representatives on such a consultation would themselves be blind or partially sighted.
Yeah, absolutely. In the language of government, they talk about co-producing with disabled people and organisations that represent disabled people. So we see our role as connecting blind and partially sighted people with decision makers so that people with lived experience are generally part of the consultation. So, for example, over 2,300 blind and partially sighted people have written to their MPs so far. Some of that has resulted in these changes today, and we want to continue that so that blind and partially sighted people are connected as part of this review.
We now know the timescale on this consultation, that it'll begin later in the summer and go on till autumn 2026. Opponents of the bill would like to see the bill withdrawn until the consultation has taken place. Is that the RNIB's position?
Well, in the short term, we are asking for the government to pause the current process, subject to all the measures in the pathway to the Work Green Paper, including the changes to PIP, to a full public consultation.
So you don't want it withdrawn, you want it paused?
Yeah, we urge MPs to vote against the bill at the second reading, and as the concessions are not enough and will create this two-tier system, we are calling for a pause to these reforms.
Mike Wordingham, thank you. Just to repeat, this programme was recorded before the debate, but that debate is only one early stage in discussion of the bill, and any tangible changes are still some way off. To get much greater clarity on how this will affect blind and partially sighted people, we need to talk to a minister, and we are continuing to press for one to appear on the programme, hopefully next week. Meanwhile, day-to-day support that we receive from organisations who represent us goes on, and sadly, we're continuing to hear of the financial struggles many of those organisations are experiencing, the latest being the Macular Society. Well, that supports people suffering from the most prevalent form of eye disease, macular degeneration. We've received a string of emails from listeners who are particularly concerned about plans to cut the number of managers of the regional groups which provide local support. Anna Baldwin emailed us about her worries.
These groups provide friendship, information and peer support for thousands of people, many of whom cannot reach the sight charities and many of whom are in despair as they find their sight failing, often quite rapidly, at a time when they are alone and beset by other difficulties. I can see that making the 17 regional managers redundant would save about £500,000, but it would totally undermine the groups and probably result in a fairly rapid closure of many, if not most of them.
And then there's this from Willow Heesum. She says,
"It's the managers who set up the new groups, but that won't happen now. There are 320 to 350 support groups all over England who depend on their excellent regional managers. They back us up and are essential to our success. They offer personal help, support and guidance. They are familiar with the group's localities, hospitals and clinicians. They encourage fundraising and most of all, they encourage us. We want the society to pause, take stock and consider the consequences of what they are doing and maybe reconsider."
Well, we've been told that discussions are still taking place at the Macular Society about possible changes. But we have this personal statement from Ed Holloway, the Society's CEO.
As the plans are still under consultation and no final decisions have been made, we're not able to share any more detail at this time. However, we'd like to be really clear that there are no plans to close any of our local support groups. The groups are a vital part of what we do, and we know how much they mean to our community and everyone living with macular disease. Whilst we are proposing some changes to our staff team, we're completely committed to continuing to support our volunteers in their essential roles. We'll share any further details as soon as we're able to do so.
Well, to Anna, Willow and all those who are concerned about this, we assure you we will interview their CEO about it as soon as we can. Now, time to lighten up a bit, I think. As a dedicated sports fan, I've always enjoyed Wimbledon. But when I was growing up, I never found a satisfactory way to play a blind version, unlike many other sports like football and cricket. But things have moved on, and now visually impaired tennis is a reality for an increasing number of people. Clubs are springing up all over the country, and one of its most enthusiastic exponents is Janice Wallace, who, as well as playing herself, has had a big hand in setting up a club in Sheffield and indeed in developing a Yorkshire league. And she joins us. Janice, first of all, what got you into visually impaired tennis? Because I gather originally it wasn't really on your radar.
No, it wasn't. I was always been a bit of a gym bunny. I wasn't into tennis at all. It all stemmed from when we were allowed back into the gyms after lockdown. And I was getting increasingly frustrated because in a class, people were coming to me and asking me to move 2 metres away from them. And of course, I can't see 2 metres in front of me, so I found it very frustrating every time I went into a class.
So that was all the restrictions that there were at the time about close contact.
Exactly. And that's when I got in touch with the RNIB, who got me in touch with my Elkington, who got me in touch with my local tennis coach, Ben Howarth. And it all started from there. I said, I just want to run about and exercise. I didn't want to know how to score. I didn't want to know any rules because I had no intention of playing any tournaments. I didn't even know there were tournaments. But obviously, since then, since starting up the club, I've had to learn how to score.
So you went from knowing nothing to forming a club, which I gather is now thriving in Sheffield.
It is, yeah. I think we are one of the, not only the fastest growing clubs, but probably one of the biggest VI tennis clubs. I don't know if there's any bigger anywhere else.
There's a Yorkshire League now.
Yes. So normally for VI tennis, when you play a regional tournaments, it's a weekend away. It's a cost implication. As a grassroots club, we wanted to play with other grassroots players and not have that cost of going away and getting to somewhere else in the UK.
But it is a very, it's now a proper competitive league that you've got.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So last year we approached Yorkshire Tennis to help us get a pilot scheme set up, which we'd done. We had a very successful pilot in November last year. Everybody turns up, everybody gets a game, and everybody goes home that same day. Plus the social aspect of it, you know, people are sitting around in the cafe and chatting and getting to know, making new friends. This year, Yorkshire Tennis have invited us to be part of their league. We have our own delivery team that deliver the VI Doubles League, and our team report to the board for Yorkshire Tennis. And I think this is the first of its kind in the UK.
But this is not just a Sheffield movement or a Yorkshire movement. It's going national. And the Lawn Tennis Association, the LTA, is playing a big part in spreading the game. And also joining us is Matt Elkington, who's the EDI programme manager at the LTA. So, Matt, I mean, what's the Lawn Tennis Association's policy now on disability tennis generally?
We do have various programmes for people with different disabilities and different impairments, whether that be a physical impairment that ends up you want to play in a wheelchair. Obviously, you see that at Wimbledon with some of our top stars like Alfie Hewitt and Gordon Reid. VI tennis, as Janice has already talked about, and we also run stuff for adults and young people with learning disabilities, and also for people with long-term health conditions, Parkinson's, etc., trying to slow the game down and showcase that, again, the sport isn't always what we see at Wimbledon. It's a lot more of a welcoming and inclusive environment than maybe what we can see at Wimbledon, where we all wear white and we've all got to be really good. Well, we can showcase it in such a different way and such a different audience.
So as far as VI tennis is concerned, any idea how many participants you've got?
Yeah, so roughly we have around 40 venues in the UK that deliver VI tennis. And out of that, we think we've got around 800 to 900 players playing regularly, which is unbelievable. The challenge we have with VI tennis is definitely the need for indoor venues. Janice will tell you, VI tennis outside can be a challenge for people who are blind and partially sighted due to the changing conditions, etc. And as the LTA, we need more and more indoor tennis courts. And in Sheffield, Janice will tell you, we haven't got enough in Sheffield, never mind in the whole of the UK.
You probably keep losing the ball outside, don't you? Is that part of the problem?
Yeah, it's definitely the changing conditions and the sun coming out and then dipping behind a cloud and the wind, etc., because the balls themselves are actually foam balls with ball bearings inside them to make people be able to hear them as they fly across the court. So, yeah, varying conditions means we do need that indoor court situation.
Now, I suggested at the beginning of the programme, Janice, that we might end up with visually impaired people being a part of the Wimbledon fortnight in the same way that wheelchair users are now. How near to that do you think we are?
Well, as part of a new scheme, Play Your Way to Wimbledon, this will be the third year that VI tennis has been played at Wimbledon in August, but in the indoor courts. I've played at Wimbledon in the indoor courts the last 2 years. Such an amazing experience, and the courts are fabulous. The hospitality was great. Everyone looked after us. And what they've done is they take the top four players from each site classification, male and female, and invite them down to play the games over a couple of days in August.
And Matt, what's the situation for this year's scheme? Obviously still to come. How can people get involved with that? Presumably the ones who are coming this year, they're already chosen, are they?
Yeah, definitely. So as Janice says, we've got players coming from all our site classifications to the Wimbledon event. It's another way, as you said, like, how do we get people to experience Wimbledon? This is another way of doing that. We've already had people qualify. You need to qualify from our regional tournaments. And obviously, you've got to try and win those tournaments or win your site classifications in order to qualify. However, next year, if you are interested and you wanted to, actually, that is a dream, I want to go and play at Wimbledon and I am blind or partially sighted, then why not get in touch with the LTA and we'll put you in touch with your local club and you can start your journey there for sure.
Right. And just more generally, if someone's listening to this and thinks, I'd love to have a go at that, not to just get to Wimbledon, I'd like to have a go at playing tennis, what would you do, Matt?
So the best thing to do is get in touch with the LTA. Our pages on our website are very informative. They give you a very detailed information around what the sport looks like. There's loads of interactive videos for people to see what tennis looks like for you. It doesn't have to look like Roger Federer and Alcaraz on at Wimbledon right now. It can look like how we need it to look like, depending on what your ability is when it comes to physical activity.
Okay, well, look, Janice Wallace, Matt Elkington, thank you both very much indeed for joining us. And that's it for today. Remember, we welcome your views, questions, comments. You can email in touch at bbc.co.uk or you can leave voice messages on 0161 836 1338. From me, Peter White, and producer Beth Hemmings, goodbye.